description.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. Today, my guest is Jeff Noon, the author most recently of Pollen, published by Crown Publishers, the author as well of the previous book, Vert, soon available in paperback, published in hardcover by Crown as well. I wanted to begin by asking, this doesn't seem to me, and it certainly wouldn't be on Bookworm if it did, the usual kind of science fiction fare. It seems to me to be more informed by, you know, poetry, by video, by all sorts of things. Where does it come from?
Well, it comes from inside my head, which is a very strange place, it must be said. I think that when I came to write Vert, I was waiting. I've been waiting to write it for a long time. I didn't realise, of course. I was actually asked to write a book by a friend of mine who had just started his own publishers. So it's quite a strange thing to do. And I'd been writing plays for a long time. I'd been in bands. I'd been painting ever since I was a kid. So I was doing lots of different things. And when I came to write Vert, it just seemed like everything that I'd been doing before suddenly had arrived in the correct place at the correct time. And Vert just kind of wrote itself, and I made it up as I went along. So, yeah, it's not science fiction. It's a kind of portrayal of what's inside my head at any particular moment of writing.
There are certain books, it seems to me, that because of their highly imaginative natures, provide very little to hold on to except themselves, mm-hmm. you know? So that as you're reading, you're holding on to dear life, because if you get lost for a second, it's like entering a Max Ernst picture. The only direction is the direction the picture gives you. And I'm curious about what they're like to write.
Oh, well, they're very exciting. I'm trying to amaze myself all the time as I write. You know, when you write, you tend to get two voices. One of them saying, brilliant, absolutely great, yes, go for it, tell people, amaze people, excite people, go on, you can do it. And the other voice is saying, oh, Jeff, man, this is so boring, why don't you just give up now? And, you know, you're just trying to nurture the voice that is telling you that you're brilliant all the time. So, you know, I'm not the kind of writer who sits down and decides he's going to write a book about, say, adultery or the Irish problem or whatever. I'm not that kind of writer. I just get the maddest ideas. And then I run with them until I've exhausted them, and then I stop. So I write a bit like jazz. I always associate it with jazz musicians improvising.
But you speak just now of voices in your head. And if there's anything that you would expect of the author of Pollen, it would be that there are voices inside the head at war with one another.
Right.
And it does seem, to me at least, to be a book that's generated by warring impulses. Not only the voices inside the head, but in Pollen, there's a mother voice, there's the voice of the animal, there's the voice of the shadow. There's the sense that people are up for grabs by any number of warring impulses.
I think that's true. I think the world that I've created is a very complex one. It's very chaotic, mainly because there are so many different ways of being in this world. Something has happened to the genetic structure of creatures and humans so that they can actually mate and they can actually produce offspring. So, for instance, in the simplest case, you've got lots of dog people on the street, half man, half dog. You've also got things like dog shadow men and dog shadow vert men and dog shadow robo vert shadows and so on. So there's lots of different ways of being, and I think in my books, the sense of individuality that we have these days has actually started to break down. We are such individuals these days. I mean, if you think back to, say, a medieval village, people who lived in the huts, you know, the farmers, they wouldn't really have a much sense of who they were. They wouldn't be looking in mirrors, for instance. We look in mirrors 24 hours a day. We're signing forms all day. The people in the medieval times wouldn't even be able to sign their name. You know, so they're having a more communal experience, which would be kind of cemented with ritual. These days, since the Renaissance Age, we've become more and more individualistic. In fact, these days we just think of ourselves as living inside our body, and we're looking out of these two holes in our head at other people. And I think that what's happened in vert and pollen, because of the technologies involved, is that people have started to lose that sense of individuality again. It's a seething mass of different kinds of things out there. And I think if you look at the books quite closely, you'll notice that the people that succeed are those that accept all the different parts, all the different voices inside them. An obvious example is in there's two dog people featured in Pollen. One's called Coyote, the other's called Clegg. Coyote completely and utterly accepts his dog side, and that's why he's such a great cab driver. And you know, because dogs know the streets. The other guy, Clegg, he's a dog cop. Now, he hates being a half-dog, and he denies it, and that's why he has such problems in life. And I think it's true in vert as well. Scribble thinks he's pure. He finds out that he's not. He's got vert inside him. And his journey in that book is to accept that.
Now, on the other hand, though, you see, this begins to sound as if the books are good-natured and interested in brotherhood, you know, and that the way to be a person in the world is to learn to accept everything. But that doesn't seem to be the impulse out of which these books are written. That is to say, you know, that may be the conscious rationalization, but the books get their narrative momentum out of setting people at each other's throats.
Yeah, of course they do. That's what writing's about. You know, it's conflict. And what you said is exactly right about rationalisation. Because of the way I write, which is to make up as I go along, I'm turning off my reasonable mind. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm constantly searching for that moment when the ego vanishes, and I'm just writing. I'm pure writing. And what happens then, of course, is that your mind actually seems to get onto a different level. It's like John Coltrane playing the saxophone, you know. And so any rationalisation that I have about these books comes much, much later. I really only start learning about these books once they're out there and people are coming back to me with ideas. And especially when I do readings, I learn a lot about how the crowd reacts to things. I'm a real optimist. I really am. I'm one of the last. And it always surprises me when people say, oh, God, they're so dark, your books, Jeff. About 5% of people actually say, oh, no, they're really in love with life.
I'm speaking to Jeff Noon, the author most recently of Pollen and of Vert as well. I have a theory about these books, I guess, which is that they seem to be about, both of them, the decay of the 60s, that they are, you know, worlds in which drugs, a certain kind of music, a certain kind of attitude toward fantasy have decayed. And so to be interested in brain trips now is to deal with the fact that between the 60s and the 90s, idealism decayed into a world patrolled by drug lords, into a place where drugs were no longer about potential or consciousness, but rather about economics and transmission deals. So it's sort of as if the books are trying to recreate a sense of possibility that was born in the 1960s and that can't be had purely in the 90s.
Well, I think you're partly right, but I wouldn't go back to the 60s. I actually take it back to 1977 and punk. Uh-huh. And Manchester, you have to understand about Manchester. Well, the thing you have to understand about Manchester is that it's a musical city. It is music. That's what it is. If you're not playing the guitar by the age of 13, there's something wrong with you in Manchester. Manchester's in the air. Music is in the air. And I was grown, you know, when I grew up, that's what I heard all the time. And I think that because punk was such an explosion, specifically in Manchester, and it caused a lot of people to actually rethink their lives and to become more creative, it certainly did for me. Not just in joining bands, but doing things like fanzines, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
There was this sudden idea that you can actually do things, you know? And England at that time wasn't a very hopeful place at all. You know, Thatcher was just arriving on the scene. So people were feeling quite depressed about that. And it was that kind of feeling, an explosion of energy, punk was. It only lasted a year, but within that year, so much happened. And I think that specifically with Vert, the first book, that could you could say that was set in 1977. To me, they're actually set in contemporary Manchester. I mean, it's interesting what you say about the 60s, because the 60s were great. I mean, you know, but I only know the 60s from thinking about them, because I wasn't there.
No, I understand completely. I'm projecting onto them my own experiences of the 60s. I guess I am saying that moment in childhood or young manhood when it seems like drugs, music, imagination, fantasy are all going to somehow lead one to a happy life, to some kind of salvation, and instead politics, economics, you know, disease, death, the whole overdosing, that war between the optimism of what you think life is going to have when you're young and creative and what actually it dishes out to you when you get older and start to realize, my God, if I don't make my own world, I'm going to be beaten by this one. I'll be eaten alive.
Well, I mean, I must admit that was one of the things that was going through my mind when I wrote Vert, because I was working in a bookshop at the time, and I really wanted to get out of the bookshop, and, you know, I wanted to affect people. I've always wanted to do that, to tell stories and to get people going. I mean, I know that me being in the bookshop is a bit like Tarantino being working in a video store, you know. Thousands of books coming in every day and vanishing, most of them. So I wanted to impress people. I wanted to... the one thing I'm after, the one thing that I'd love people to think when they're reading is, my God, how did he work that out? How did he think of that? What the hell's going to happen next? You know, because that's very much the state that I'm constantly trying to get to as I write.
I'm curious, what were the books in which that state was arrived at for you?
Books that I've read in the past? Well, I think J.G. Ballard is very important to me. His sense of the future. And I think that the first Ballard book I read was Crash, which is one most extreme books of all time, you know. And I can remember buying this book, not having a clue what it was, because it had a really tacky cover on, and at this market stall. And it said on the back, a hideous warning. And I kind of picked it up and read it. And about page three, I thought, this is no warning. I mean, this is a celebration. This guy loves this stuff. You know, he loves technology. He loves the future. And that was the first science fiction I'd ever read that had that feeling. And because the old science fiction tended to be quite down on technology, it was hideous warnings, you know. And then, of course, you get people like William Gibson coming along, who takes it even further. I mean, talk about celebration of the future. I mean, the first page of Neuromancer is just it's sheer excitement of the prose and the ideas. And that young kids have finally got the gear, you know. It's not scientists anymore. It's kids on the streets. Mm.
It's funny because my first sense of that book that seemed to turn with every page was Alfred Bester, a book called The Demolished Man. And there is that crazy half-world of science fiction where it's more...
Yeah, that's a real 60s thing. The science fiction in the 60s was so experimental, it actually became the new avant-garde.
Yes.
And, you know, people like Bester were at the forefront of that. I mean, that obviously has stopped to a large extent. People aren't that interested in the avant-garde anymore, especially in novels. So it's kind of turned, and with people like when Ballard came along and Gibson, you're back to storytelling again. You know, but they're still very experimental books. It's just that the experiment is now with the content, not the form.
Yes. Yes, it was interesting because I remember Ballard in America, there was a book that kept trying to be published. It would be on the Grove list every year, and lawsuits would keep it off. It was given various titles elsewhere, and so it had three titles when it came out here. It was called, I think, The Atrocity Exhibition, Love and Napalm, Export USA.
Right.
And because there were chapters about the John F. Kennedy assassination considered as a crucifixion, or Jacqueline Kennedy's breasts becoming maps for rocket parabola, there was a whole world. It was part William Burroughs, The sections of it were published both in science fiction magazines, but also in avant-garde literary magazines. And there was that wonderful intersection where it looked for half a minute as if the kids who love subgenres and the intellectuals who love the avant-garde were going to meet and kiss and shake hands and make a new literature of the
future.
Well,
that was the great thing about Ballard. He could have done that. And unfortunately, what happened is, especially in Britain, I don't know about America, but in Britain he was ignored by the critics, specifically because they thought it was science fiction, and critics don't look at science fiction. Of course, he was writing for 25 years, great novels about the state of the country and about the state of the national psyche. And it was only when Ballard did The Empire of the Sun that the critics suddenly realised, oh, God, he's good, isn't he? And I was saying, yeah, well, 25 years, man, where were you, you know?
Well, it's almost as if there's a sense of writers graduating. Now, finally, he's writing a novel taking place in historical time that is quasi-autobiographical, that has, if not a clear moral view, at least the attempt to arrive at a clear moral view. It's as if these people, and I don't know where they're from and how they're born or how they're raised, are impatient until they get that one narrow sliver that they've been waiting for all along, and then they say, here.
Exactly. I mean, it's frustrating. But, I mean, you know, more power to him. He's great.
I wondered, that doorway, and you know, Pollan is obsessed with meeting places between worlds where, you know, dream and reality meet around a thin slit that's sometimes painful to cross. That joining point, which is also the joining point of logic and fantasy, seems to have been pioneered by Lewis Carroll.
Well, it was pioneered by the Victorians. I think the Victorians were, because they were repressing their feelings so much, I think they needed that doorway because that made it safe. I mean, the doorway has been around in Britain since then. I mean, it sometimes it's in a mirror, sometimes it's in the back of a wardrobe. And in my book, for some strange reason, it's in a feather that you put into your mouth. It's always fascinated me, that idea that there is this other world just parallel to ours, if you could only find the doorway. And I think that the doorways in the book, they're quite similar to the number of maps that are in the book as well, because if you could only get the map, you had this idea that you would know where to go. You know, of course, it's not like that at all. All the maps, like every character in Pollan has a different map of Manchester. It might be a real map they're carrying, or it could be an imaginary map in their head. Or there's a computerised map even. All of them are slightly different, but they all admit to portraying reality.
In trying to isolate the abstract quality of the book, I found a sentence that seemed to me to be illustrative of what we're talking about. This is when one of a series of shifts, of ontological shifts, has occurred, and the conclusion is provisionally drawn. So the map is made out of roots, and the city is a flower that grows from the sap of the map. There's a kind of reasoning that occurs only when you've penetrated deeply enough. Does a sentence like that begin to make sense? It's required.
Right.
And I wondered if you can talk about that point.
That point? Yeah. I think that both books start off quite conventionally, although in the sense that they look like they're going to be traditional narratives. It's just that there's a little bit of strangeness going on. Eventually what happens is that they start to unpeel almost, and the traditional narrative starts to drop away. Like Pollen, for instance, starts off very much like a detective novel. Ed McBain on acid, if you like. That seems to be forgotten after a time.
I don't think I would like Ed McBain on
acid.
Oh,
right, okay. As soon as they realise that it's not just the victims of the murders that count, it's the murderer and what the murderer's up to, and then what exactly is the weapons that the murderer is using, because they're not traditional weapons. People are getting killed by flowers. It's like, it always reminds me of that the Lou Reed song, "Yours, Baby, You're So Vicious, You Hit Me With A Flower, You Do It Every Hour." It's such an anomaly to kill people with flowers, you know. And so what happens is that as the traditional narrative slips away, it becomes a kind of, I always call it, it's a vertical narrative, that the characters are forced to go deep and deep into worlds beyond the world they've just been in. And eventually, there must come a point in that kind of narrative where they actually start to make sense of, oh God, we're here, this is it, this is what it's like. And that happens at certain points, both in Vert and Pollen. The thing about Pollen is that it's a multi-person narrative. Vert is a mad rush. I mean, it's a young man's novel. He's just rushing through the city. He's after his goal. The goal keeps getting away from him. You know, where is it? Let me get at it. It's a very quick read. What I did with Pollen is that I moved back. I always think that I'm in a helicopter when I'm writing Pollen, looking at the city, trying to build up a picture of what it is like in Manchester. So it's a kind of a jigsaw thing. And there's lots of different characters, all of them circling around. At the same time, the pollen count is rising and the hay fever epidemic is growing and people are being killed by sneezing.
One of the things I've always liked to think about, you know, most jigsaw puzzles, depending upon the company that makes them, are cut with the identical die. Mm. All of the pieces and all of the puzzles are the same. That is to say that if you were to get the 26 or 27 puzzles that one company manufactures, you could put together a master jigsaw puzzle that would fit together.
Have you ever read Life of User's Manual?
Yes, indeed.
That is a great book. That if is you want to know about jigsaws, that's the one. Of course, the old jigsaws, and going back to the Victorian age, the old jigsaws were cut by craftsmen with irregular pieces.
Yes, indeed. But the funny thing is, because Perec and others are always bemoaning the passing of the craftsman and the passing of the wooden puzzle, but in fact, it's funny. You see, although no one puzzle can give the pleasure of those old puzzles, if you interstrew 8 or 9, not only can you make a picture of intersecting nothing,
right.
But it is essentially a novel, or the picture, the ground plan of a novel much more like Pollen or Life of User's Manual by mm-hmm. Georges Perec, a magnificent book, probably the ultimate of the tradition of the puzzle novel, the novel that comes apart in pieces and reassembles itself again and again and again until finally, out of inanition, just decides to stop.
It's a great book.
I'm speaking to Jeff Noon, the author most recently of Pollen. I bring up the Victorians and Alice in Wonderland simply because, A, in these books, the Wonderland are sort of horror lands to begin with. The concept of Wonderland or Oz has changed so that now where we've got Wonderlands that are almost entirely composed of people asking to have them cut off her head, or Oz's that are all Wicked Witch. Mm-hmm. But I know also that you're working on a futurist Alice, called Automated Alice.
There's a great book by the mathematician Martin Gardner called The Annotated Alice, and, you know, absolutely the best way to look at Alice. One of those strange books that takes something apart but doesn't at any point ruin it, doesn't destroy it. And I've always looked at that book because I love Alice, and that is one of my favourite books, The Annotated Alice. And it was just lying on my desk, this is about 6 years ago, say, and I was looking at it, and the title started to change, and it became Armour-Plated Alice. And into my head came this image of this kind of steam-driven Victorian doll who looked a little bit like Alice did. I thought, that's quite interesting. And then the title changed again, Automated Alice. And it became a robot. It became a kind of a Blade Runner replicant, a perfect model of Alice. And I thought, well, that's interesting, you know, and you kind of, you know, you get ideas and some of them are good, some of them aren't, but that was a good one, but it was a dangerous one. So I just kind of put it aside, and it was only when I came to write Pollen and Alice actually turns up near the end of Pollen dying that I thought, oh, it's time. So I decided to write this book, and the premise is that Lewis Carroll, just before he died in 1888, wrote a third Alice book that he didn't show anybody. Alice, the real Alice, of course, was by this time married. they find this book in his papers, and it's called Automated Alice. And in it, he sends Alice through a clock's face, and she travels through time and lands in 1998 in Manchester. So it's Alice's adventures on the streets of Manchester and a journey to try and get back to the past in time for a 2 o'clock writing lesson. And she has what you said before about Wonderland has become darker. I'm afraid that my version of Alice is a lot darker than the first two, because in the first two Alices there was talk of death and there was hints of drugs. In this, people do get killed and people do take drugs. There's also lots of fun and games and puzzles in it and things like that.
I wonder, this is the final question, but can you guess at why this intersection so often in the very best books of mathematics and poetry?
Oh, well, my view on that is that what's happened in the 20th century is that scientists have taken over the realms of the imagination. If you look at what scientists are coming up with, it's much more imaginative than what artists are coming up with. For instance, fractals. When I first read about fractals a long time ago, and it said that a fractal is a shape between the dimensions, and it was had all these formulas and said this fractal has got a dimension of 1.46. So we all know what the first dimension is. We all know what the second and third dimensions are, but what the hell is something with a dimension of 1.46? Now, it's my contention that if you put a bunch of novelists and an artist in a room for a year, they won't come up with that.
Mm-hmm.
But not only did these scientists come up with it, they actually prove it. And you've seen that again and again with chaos theory, complexity theory, relativity, that scientists have almost released their imagination in this century. You can see that in the rise of the popular science book. People... the Stephen Hawking book. You know, people want to know because it's suddenly become much more fascinating than it used to be. The universe became strange and was proven to be strange. It's almost like you mentioned poetry. It was as though poetry had entered the universe.
Yes, and so science became a proof of the strangeness of the universe.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think the artists and writers have been kind of lagging behind a bit.
QED, that the universe is strange.
Mm.
I've been speaking to Jeff Noon, the author most recently of Pollen, published by Crown, the author as well of Vert. Thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.
Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.